KPCW News Time now, 8:18. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, about a week ago, a number of businesses in Moab were raided by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE. What we know is that 9 residents taken into custody. Many more people, though, have been affected. On the phone to talk about the raid and what lessons Park City could get from it, I have Moab Police Chief Jim Winder along with Rihanna Medina. She is the executive director of the executive director of the Moab Valley Multicultural Center. It looks like I've already lost Rihanna. So are you still there, Chief Winder?
I am. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, we'll see if we can get her back on there. Rihanna, are you there now?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Well, Chief, let's just start with you. What can you tell us about the raid itself? Were you notified that ICE was coming?
Yes. I want to be very clear, however, your listeners should be aware that when Immigration Customs Enforcement contacts law enforcement, they do so in a courtesy fashion. They don't provide details about the nature of the operation or many specifics at all. The purpose from my perspective is to alert us that when they're in the community, if a situation occur that local law enforcement might be needed, that we would be at least aware of it. But that's the extent of the notification that we would receive.
Right. So where did the raids actually happen? You didn't know about, did they give you locations or?
No, they don't provide any specificity. And again, the characterizing this as a raid, I'll leave that for Ms. Medina. She has quite a bit more information on the specifics, but from law enforcement's perspective, when ICE comes, their visits can often entail simple compliance checks where they would come and, essentially administrative. They might go to businesses and ensure that the forms that are required by employers have been filled out properly and they're just verifying. Or it could be to the extent where they come down with, prepared to make significant numbers of arrests. I don't know really how this transpired. Maybe Ms. Medina does.
Yeah, can you help us with that, Rihanna?
Sure. We still really do not know what the motivation was for ICE coming this past Friday, which is unfortunate because it just leaves a lot of speculation. I wish we could explain it to everybody so it would make sense, and then people would have answers to those questions. But no, we don't know why they came.
No tip or complaint then. I mean, they're not going to share that information with you.
They're not. No.
So where did they show up? ICE officials.
Where did they show up, or
yeah.
When did they show up?
Where?
They showed up to various homes and employers and did several traffic stops.
So you wouldn't describe this in as a raid? What would you describe it as?
Well, the Multicultural Center hasn't been using the word raid. You know, we've there was a lot of fear and panic, and we've been using the term targeted arrest. Because it seems from all the information that we have that it's fair to say that there were individuals that they were looking for specifically, and it wasn't random. They didn't just take anybody, scoop up anybody, and go into businesses and take anyone that they could. They did seem to be looking for some very specific individuals.
And what do you know about those individuals? Did they have warrants out for their arrest, or were they wanted for perhaps drug dealing, or do you know?
We know very little because we've been working with the families of the people who were detained, and from what the information that we have is really all over. They all have different situations, and that's which is why we all can't really speculate as to the reason why ICE came for those specific people, because they all do have different situations.
Yeah. So can you both talk about how this has impacted your community I mean, because it's not really, it's not both, it's not only economically, because I had heard that a number of people just didn't show up for work for a couple of days, but there's also, it sounds like, some emotional effects as well.
I'd be happy to discuss some of that from our perspective in law enforcement, and I want to be careful about speculation. I appreciate very much Ms. Medina and the Multicultural Center's approach in terms of trying to be circumspect about what this was and characterizing it. But one has to realize that, you know, when immigration comes into town, they, as I said, the motive can vary greatly. They may have, in fact, been coming down with specific information about some aggravated reentry individuals with that they felt were a risk to the community, any number of things. That really is, frankly, less important. The reality of it is when you know, immigration comes into a community, especially of our size, where we have such a reliance on migrant labor, both documented and undocumented, and that's, you know, I'm saying nothing that no one doesn't know, and any community is similarly situated. When that happens, and it and nowadays, especially with social media, the ripple of fear and confusion that that emanates, it is kind of, you know, underlied by your question. Why did they come? No one knows. Therefore, they're very, very, people are very afraid. They don't know if this is going to be, you know, a mass roundup. Is it going to be individual? Is it going to last for 2 days? Is it going to, you know, you name it. And so what we experienced was a significant amount of, you know, confusion and fear. And if you can imagine in a town our size that, you know, where every business, you know, is suddenly affected, people were removing their children from schools, physically leaving town. You know, we were getting communications at our department about what this was or wasn't. It was a very interesting event, and I would say we'll have some fairly, you know, lasting impacts. Most specifically, fear amongst the migrant community, both legal and illegal, of communicating with police. And that's something that I think is very, very unfortunate.
Yes. What are you hearing from your officers in terms of that, in relations with the Latino community?
Well, it's what we're not hearing that is concerning. And let me, you know, we've been working over the course of the last, specifically about the last, you know, 18 months or perhaps even more, trying to bridge the gap to ensure that people that are here understand that they have legal rights because they are persons in the United States that deserve the protection of law enforcement. We want them to come forward and report when they are the victims of domestic violence, when their kids are experiencing bullying or other issues within the schools, when there is neglect or abuse, or when they have information about felony behavior, drug dealing, etc. And from my standpoint, that was beginning to happen, or it felt like we were having those kinds of communications. It remains to be seen, because you don't know what you don't know. You know, but are we now going to have people who retract back into the community and suffer because, you know, of this particular event? And that's something that, you know, we're not going to cure in Moab, but it's something that's going to, has to be a conversation everywhere. And not to be the, you know, the harbinger of doom here, but this kind of event could happen immediately in Park City or Wendover or Durango or any community that, you know, is similarly situated. We have very similar demographics.
Right. I mean, did you actually have to have, did businesses close down just because they weren't able to staff them and keep them open?
Rihanna, I don't know about you. I didn't hear about anybody actually closing their doors, but I did hear where, you know, managerial staff or other people were having to fill the gap, and that certainly business was impacted. You know, hotels were having difficulty getting rooms turned. Meals were, you know, being delayed or not served. Patrons, in some instances, I'm sure, were turned away. So businesses were definitely affected.
I think Friday and Saturday were the hardest days for businesses. And I do know that a couple of restaurants actually did have to close on a busy Friday night. But I do, you know, that's not to say that everybody who worked there was undocumented. People were just afraid.
Yeah,
to go to work.
And that's what I've heard, is that, that even the documented immigrants were fearing for their safety and staying home. I mean, I guess, how can you help with that, Rihanna, given, I mean, just the knowledge that if they have the necessary documents, that they are safe?
Well, that's really difficult. You know, there's no guarantee for anything. We can tell people to, we can reassure them just what you said. If you have your necessary documents, you can absolutely cooperate. You know, interacting with any kind of law enforcement can be a little bit of a scary, it can be scary, you know, nerve-wracking. But if you didn't do anything wrong, then you really shouldn't have anything to be afraid of. And along with what Chief Winder was saying, a lot of the rumors that ensued when this happened was when we were getting phone calls for the on Friday and Saturday, a lot of them were saying that they were seeing that they saw ICE and they were really afraid. And when we verified what they were talking about, they just had seen regular local law enforcement. So I think that we saw people in the community confusing ICE with local law enforcement, and that's exactly what we don't want to happen for the exact reasons that Chief Winder just listed.
Yeah. Park City has estimated its Latino population at about 25%, and that's within the school district. So any idea how large the Latino community is in Moab?
I think I've always estimated it to be approximately 15%, and that's my own estimation. The census puts it at much lower than that, but that's where I would say.
Yeah. And I certainly know that hindsight is, you know, 2020. I mean, anything you know now that could have better prepared you and the community for something like this?
Well, that's a good question.
I think that if I might take a stab at that, I think moving forward, and again, Rihanna and I have talked about this, but I think, you know, I lived through the the circumstances when the Utah legislature was attempting to modify the state statutes to enable state officers to engage in law enforcement, and it created, you know, this was post 1070 out of Arizona, and in the Salt Lake Valley, we spent significant amount of time doing community outreach with communities to explain to them the differences between local law enforcement and federal officers, and also to talk about basic interactions with law enforcement. And I felt that was a very, very helpful event. It opened up lines of communications, and it seemed to, you know, the one thing about this particular community is the lines of communication are pretty strong. And I think when we can get out ahead of it and tell people, we'll never be able to allay the fear about immigration affecting individuals out of status. We know that. What we've got to really try and focus on is allaying the broader panic that can ensue about, you know, local law enforcement's interactions and what they can expect that way. I think that's the key, is to get out ahead of it and let people know that, you know, anybody here that's out of status, they, I think, inherently know there's a risk. But they also need to know what the realities of living in this country are outside of that context.
Yeah, and Rihanna, anything you think Park City could take away from Moab's experience?
Yeah, it's really, really important. What I guess came to my mind is that, you know, regardless of your status, having an emergency plan for if something happens, you know, if you, God forbid, get into a car accident or there's a natural disaster, this is kind of what emergency planning is for. And at the center, we have some really great forms that we have gathered from different organizations that they've shared with us. And this happened a couple of years ago in Moab, and People have been coming into the center since things have calmed down and revising their emergency plans or asking for a new form. And that's really, really important. Who do you want your kids to go with if something like this were to happen? What, you know, your bank account, your vehicles. I mean, people have whole lives here. And if something, you know, something, an emergency happens, you should have a plan.
Yeah, good advice. Anything else either of you'd like to say about this?
I guess on a more macro note, I would hope, and, you know, this is probably pie in the sky, but I think this demonstrates, you know, this broader national conversation about trying to figure out in the long term how we're going to, you know, manage this. There's no way to kind of run a country where, you know, you're in one hand, you're relying on people to make your economy move forward. And on the other hand, you're impacting communities like this. There has to be a better way from a structural perspective to ensure that people can come here, fill these jobs, and it's a clearer. But again, you know, we've been struggling with this for how long?
All right. And Rhianna, anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think that I agree. I hope that some conversations can be had on the bigger level. There's only so much that we can do at the local level, but it does, you know, make us kind of see who are the people who are making these decisions on a macro level as far as immigration law. And it is what we have right now is definitely not working. And the people in our community, these are the people who go to our schools and our neighbors and our friends, and they're humans. And it's really, there's the law and then there's the human beings and, you know, knowing somebody. And it's all really, really difficult when those two don't mesh.
All right. Well, I appreciate both your time. Moab Police Chief Jim Winder and Rhianna Medina is the Executive Director of the Moab Multicultural Center. Thanks again for your time. 8:36 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, Park City Council Member Tim Henney. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie.
Anything you'd like to add about that? I mean, when I just asked the two folks from Moab after that roundup there, any lessons for Park City? I mean, is it something that City Council has considered at all?
I think City Council and our entire community has considered this, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, but in terms of, I don't know, we're talking about social equity. I mean, and Ms. Medina had a good point there in terms, I mean, it's probably good information for anybody, but
yeah,
in the event of an emergency, have information that people can move forward with.
It's heartbreaking, though, that people would have to factor that component into their emergency planning. I mean, are you kidding me? You know, this is about the identity of a community. Are you going to be inclusive and hopeful, or are you going to be hateful and create despair?
Well, let's move on to social equity. Council holding another study session, this time focused on the upcoming listening tours. It sounds like you had an interesting conversation. Council Member Steve Joyce mentioned his visit with PC Unidos, saying it was a good meeting. I guess he was wondering why council is having another meeting on the cusp of hiring a convener to do all of this.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think it was well explored and answered. We had different members of the community at the table with us, and the sense that where we arrived after kind of discussing that was we should continue to have the meetings because there's benefit to the process. We don't want to hold the process up until we actually have named the convener, gone to contract, and they have begun their work. That can happen on parallel tracks, and they complement each other. So that's kind of where we ended up.
All right. You heard from Jed Briggs that we're going to be recommending, or staff recommends, the PC Park City Community Foundation as to be hired as the convener. Do we know what their ask is or anything part
no,
of their
No, we
proposal?
Don't have any. We didn't get any details. Just, and I think that they were trying to not discuss that because they want to come to us at the next council meeting with the actual presentation and the specifics. So he did just give us the heads up that they were the recommended convener.
OK, Council has budgeted $100,000. Is you going to stick to that amount?
I believe so. Yeah, I haven't heard anything other.
Okay. And it was interesting. Yesterday you had actually somebody sit down with you wearing a headset that using the City Hired Translator.
Yeah.
Did actually, he respond?
The translator was Nena. She translated. She was in the audience sitting next to this gentleman. And we did have a translator in the room also who is doing a broadcast translation for everybody in the room wearing the headsets. But so, you know, it was very interesting because what this gentleman spoke to, again, was the identity of the community and the core values of the community. And he said he referred to them as parameters and rules. These are the rules of our community. And what he spoke to were our four core values that were identified in the community survey that was done in 2009 and carry forward today and are the genesis and the foundation of the general plan, which then, of course, gets codified in the land management code. But it really is the vision and what we talk about as to who we are and what our DNA is. And it gets back to that, are we a community that excludes and creates fear? Are we a community that is welcoming, inclusive, gives voice to everybody equally, and that ties right into social equity. So, yeah, there's a big component there of community identity.
All right. I think it was Nena who said that that she thought the council's making the definition of social equity harder than it needs to be. It really just comes down to mutual respect. I mean, is that something? Is that what you, do you agree with that, or do
well, we? Well, I think it's one of the core components. Absolutely, and you know, maybe we are overthinking it, but you know, that's kind of what you have to do when you bring some of these topics to the surface and you start to have a community conversation. I mean, you could say we overthink events. We overthink, you know, a whole bunch of things in this community. But I think that's part of the process, and I think that's very healthy. And I think the fact that we're having these workshops and we've had Kilo up and we're discussing this in the way that we are, and the difficulty of defining social equity is still there. So it shows me that, yes, we can talk about the core components, but we have to also talk about how you connect that overarching statement of people being welcomed and valued and safe and tie it into practical, implementable components. And that's the difficult part, the in-between, and that's a little tougher. And that's what we're really spending our time on.
You also heard from the members of Class 24 Leadership Group sharing their year of leadership training and their passion of food waste. They said that Park City is leading the nation in so many areas, and to make food waste a part of that legacy is something we should consider. They didn't ask for anything in particular, though, I don't believe, or...
Well, what they did ask for was that we continue to examine this and do what we can in Park City to support Summit County. Summit County handles our waste stream, and they have worked on a master plan. And I know that food waste and organic material and composting is part of that master plan. And it's going to cost more money. That's what it always comes down to. So I think what they're asking for is some energy and some focus and some commitment from the community. They see it at the grassroots level. They talked about that, and they identified that. And I think you and I, you know, just like the bag ban, we talked about why don't we ban bags? And it was like, well, you know, you could just stop using plastic bags. I mean, you could have done that well before a bag ban. So we're kind of in that phase. Are we going to just have it voluntary? Because you can compost. It takes some money, personal money. It takes some effort. It's not the easiest thing to do, but you can do it. So the options exist today. Should we make it a broader initiative? Should we find, you know, tax dollars or some sort of, you know, way to fund this? And what's Park City's role in that? And I think other than just being supportive, they're looking at us. They're looking for us to take the next step and be a little more than just supportive and figure out a way to work with Summit County to possibly codify some sort of recycling in general.
That's impressive, though. I mean, the amount of space we could save in our landfill if this was part of it. Yeah,
we divert a very small fraction of the waste. I think it's between 15% and 20% right now. And a lot of communities have figured out ways to divert up to 30%. And just that filling in that gap, and we should be at 30 or higher. I mean, again, community identity, what are the values that we stand for? We should be leading on waste diversion. That's something that I think this community stands for. If we could do that, we could extend the life of the landfill cell by decades.
Transit, you met your new transit system manager, Barbara Murdoch. You also heard from Public Works Director Blake Fonsbeck. City receiving another $2.3 million for 10 buses. I don't know if it was going to pay for all 10. But
it won't, but it'll fill in the gap between what we would pay for buses anyway, and we have funding sources for that. And so to cover the difference between, you know, your standard diesel bus and your electric bus, we use these grants to kind of fill in that difference.
All right, and we're talking about buying those long-distant haul buses?
Yeah, they're the ones with the two motors and the multiple axles, and we rode one from the transit center last year up to, I think we went all the way up to the Montage, and these things outperform the diesel buses on the climb up to the Montage, and they will be able to make the run from Park City down to Salt Lake and back and out to Camas and back to Park City. So we are going to electrify the Salt Lake Connect, which is so exciting, and we are going to electrify the Camas commuter, which is equally exciting, and we are converting our fleet to electric, and this is a big step in that direction because these are the long-haul ones. That's where you get the biggest bang for your buck, and getting diesel out of that and electric in is tremendously impactful.
All right, and then have we started talking at all about just smaller buses then for the neighborhood runs?
We talk about that all the time, and when I say we at the staff level, they're talking about that all the time and looking at those opportunities and options, and I know that that's an active investigation and discussion.
All right. And then also wanted to bring up the traffic control center. Apparently, we've got much of the equipment and software in place. And is it actually a physical building or is it within the police department?
Yeah,
or how does this work?
Within the police department and using some of the existing space that has been vacated due to dispatch being moved to Summit County. We do have a dispatch center there that's available for emergency use if we have to default to that. But we also have additional space that's now vacant, and they can go right in there with this traffic operation. So it's just a little bit of hardware. I think it was something like $90,000 for the hardware upfront costs, and then something like $32,000 for the personnel and to manage it for about a 6-month period of time.
So how's this going to help us? And just looking back at like Arts Festival, where people sitting on the bus were sitting on the bus and not moving when they got onto Bonanza Drive.
Well, some of that it's not going to help with. You know, if we have so much traffic on Bonanza and you don't have the ability for the buses to get into a bus lane, that's a different component of our traffic problems that we're trying to address with other measures. But this will take some of the flow control away from the state agencies and put it into the hands of our local agencies. And that's a good thing. The response time will be much quicker. As an example, when one of the lights goes out in any of our signals on any of the roads, it takes an hour for personnel to get from Salt Lake up to Park City to address that. That's just a delay that we can hopefully address by bringing more of that control closer to home and dealing with it right here in Park City. So it's that sort of thing, getting local control for more flexibility, better programming on the variable message boards. That was another aspect of this. And those are all things that can only help us.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Tom?
You know, you talked earlier about Craig Cooper and Charlie Sturgis, and, you know, I just want to shout out to those guys. I mean, it's tremendous that they've been recognized for their service to the community by Rotary, a good example of, you know, what makes Park City, Park City. So thanks.
Okay. Tim Henney, Park City Council member, thank you for your time.
You bet.
Park City Institute presents Nashville Cafe as its final show of the Big Stars Bright Night concert series this summer. On the phone is one of the performers for the September 2nd show, Charles Esten. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it'll be you and one of your co-stars on the program, Nashville Chris Carmack. Now, is this put together then by the Park City Institute, or do you and Chris actually tour together?
We have actually toured together. We've toured together as part of the Nashville touring show. Right after the show, we would go on the road with some of our castmates. But he and I have done the same as well, as have Claire and I. There's been various different permutations, but I'm real happy to go out with Chris. He's an incredible artist in his own right. That's the cool thing about Nashville, is that all these people that you saw singing and playing music are able to do it and have done it on their own. So that's what makes it special when I get to do it with a buddy like that.
Yeah. So for those of us who haven't seen the program, I mean, was it built around the characters? Or was it built around the music? Or?
Well, I'd say they were inextricably linked, actually. That was the thing that I came to find about the show that really drew me first, was that neither one took a back seat in terms of the scenes or the songs. So often in a musical of some sort, the scene is the important thing, and then you just sort of, hey, let's sing a song. And that was never the case. And the quality of music was kept in that way as well. Of course, our show was created by the great Callie Curry, Oscar-winning screenwriter, did, of course, Thelma and Louise and many other great things. But our music at the beginning was shepherded and helmed by T-Bone Burnett, her husband. And if anybody knows T-Bone, they know the level of quality that he's after with music and truth. So between the two of them starting us off, it was the best footing available, best footing possible, I should say, because you would be doing a scene, and whereas some other shows, that's really the depths you could plumb of that emotion. But there's something about music that lets you go to another level, and that's how it always was with the show. And that's why, even though the show's finished, the catalog that we were given, the songs that we were given from the show, they absolutely stand up, and I'll be happy to sing them the rest of my life.
Yeah. Now, so do you consider yourself an actor or a musician and a singer?
Well, that was the beauty of Nashville, is that for a time I didn't have to answer. We were doing both. As it stands now, I still might not give you a straight answer. I started off in music as a kid, taking piano lessons and guitar and songwriting. And in college, I was in a band. I led a band for about 4 or 5 years. And but then when that was finishing up and all my bandmates were going off to do normal jobs in business or as doctors, et cetera, I went out to Los Angeles to be an actor. I think then I figured I would get to do both. And in some instances, I did. I would improvise songs on Whose Line Is It Anyway? I played Buddy Holly in a musical. But for the most part, I didn't. I sort of had to put music in the back seat until all these years later, this role and this script came along that let me step right back into that world of being able to say both as my answer. And I'm going to hang on to that one for as long as I can.
Yeah. So for the September 2nd show, then, will you and Chris play solo and then come together? Or do you plan to be together for the entire show?
No, we do play solo because that's how, and generally our characters are rarely sang together, Will Lexington and Deacon Claiborne on the show, but he gets his time out on the stage and I get mine, and then we do come together. I join him on stage for one of his, he'll join me at the end for a couple of mine. That's how we've always done it, and on top of that, we're not just playing the Nashville songs. Chris, as I said, is a great songwriter in his own right and a great guitarist, so he'll be playing a combination of his and Nashville's and even a cover or two. I'm in the same boat, so it really travels all over. We don't want to stay in one place. If you're a Nashville fan, you're going to love it. And if you have not yet watched Nashville, this is maybe the best introduction, is to hear some of these songs and meet us. We frequently hear the people that get taken there by their friends afterwards are like, well, they're going to go watch it now, and that's a great review.
Right. So how much input then did you have in terms of the music that you performed on the program?
Well, the input was what they allowed us by, in terms of, I think they were very wise to allow us. They want the songs to not just fit the scene. And by the way, they did fit the scene. We never just had a song that was, hey, what a great song, we should sing it here. It always had to be not just the best song, but the best song for that moment in the show. But on top of that, they were wise enough not to ignore who we were and what we were comfortable with, and certainly where our voices were. They would always find out what key we should sing it in. We would be in the studio very frequently with the musicians as they pulled together the song to figure out what would be the best version of the song for our individual talents. On top of that, I had Deacon Claiborne, my character, over the course of the 6 seasons, had 30 songs. Over the course of the whole show, we had over 300, which was an insane amount of production, especially with the level they kept it at. But for my 30 songs, I'm also very proud to be able to say that I wrote three of them. I co-wrote two of them and wrote one myself. So they did give us some input, and I thought that was a pretty intelligent way to do that, because we always wanted to make sure that when you watch these performances, that like every scene, the song has to have a truth about it as well. It had to connect, and I think that was one of the ways they made sure that it did.
Okay, so we'll see a piano on stage. We'll have both of you playing guitar. Is that?
Yeah, we also have a band as well. When I say a band, we have a great band, a Nashville band, and we'll be the various permutations of the song. There will be some that will be just a guitar, and there will be some where a little louder, a little more upbeat. So I think that's always another important thing for me in a concert, just like in a scene or in a show. If you watch a television show and it's stated in one emotion and sort of one level, the whole show, that would get very boring very quickly. In fact, that's almost the definition of a bad scene. It stays in one place, or a bad show stays in one place. I think it's the same with a concert. So we want to move around. You'll have moments where it's, you know, very, very still, and you know, you're singing something very dramatic and emotional, and then you'll have other moments where you're just rocking, flat out having a great time. So that's pretty much what it is, which doesn't let you identify with the one thing, but that's what it is.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the TV show has finished its sixth and final season. Now what?
Well, the great thing, as an actor, that's always the question, now what, no matter how long the show lasts. But I lived in the world of now what forever. This was the first show that I had that lasted over two seasons. I've been doing this about 25 years, over 25 years, and I've always been more of the guest star, the guy that did like 8-episode arc on, for instance, like The Office or Big Love, or ER, so different shows like that. So for me, six seasons was the longest I've had without What Next. Now that we come to What Next, the great part about it is that this music, as I said, been made a part of my life again. So What Next, while I'm waiting for whatever that great show is I get to tour and play this music and write and produce my own music. So that goes back to your initial question, that it's a back and forth between the two, and it's actually, in that sense, a perfect dance, because I'm not doing nothing while I'm waiting. And meanwhile, I'm also going to be recurring on a great show on TNT called Tell Me Your Secrets, and I have a small role in that. So for now, I'm getting to do both and hope to continue that down the road.
Again, well, Charles Esten and Chris Carmack making up Nashville Cafe, performing again the final season of the show Sunday, September 2nd at City Park. Tickets and more information online at echocenter.org or by calling the box office 435-655-3114. Look forward to the show. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for your
time. Lord, I pray I have a life that's good.